The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Happy Father's Day.
Yes, happy Father's Day.
Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, Elizabeth.
I think I just broke my... No, I didn't. You are joining We the People Radio. It's Sunday, as it always is, when we tune in, and it's Father's Day. And happy Father's Day to all the men out there. Some folks are fathers of four-legged creatures, and some are fathers of nieces and nephews and grandchildren. So whoever you are, wherever you are, whoever you are caring for, happy Father's Day. I just rushed in from our local Benton Air Park, where they're having a great event. They've got all kinds of airplanes and helicopters, a big, huge pancake breakfast. They're giving free rides to the kids. Well, not exactly free, 15 cents a pound. Gathered up my niece and two neighbor kids, and we were out there at,
we were out there at
7 a.m., getting breakfast, and the kids were the first ones on the plane, so I got to see them on the plane, but didn't see them take off. But it was, it's a great event. When we arrived, there were very few cars, and when I left an hour later, there was parking all the way up and down the street.
Nice!
And saw our great friend Mr. Wilkinson out there.
Of course.
Mr. Wilkinson.
Did you see Mrs. Wilkinson?
I did not see Mrs.
She's like
Wilkinson.
A shadow. She's so quiet.
Yes, she is. So anyway, if you're not doing anything today, folks, head out to Benton Air Park. They got a lot of activities, all kinds of stuff for kids, all kinds of rides.
Is that why you were so early? Were you early?
I was. I got there, yes. I said we're getting there at 7 a.m. because then they will be the first ones on the plane. We can get out of there while it's cool.
I was dilly-dallying. I thought I was good. We got in the car. We're like, it's 8:01. What the heck? Oh, yes. And the race continues.
So, while you're
Bob,
joining...
how are we situated?
Our guests are standing by.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you?
Awesome.
How are you situated?
I'm situated. I'm here. I'm sitting, and I'm waited.
You're in the situated room? Because we're moving to...
And Bill's good.
Bill's good. We're moving to our top secret show.
Yeah.
See the page Robert put up?
I did.
Okay, folks, if you have not gone to wethepeopleradio.us and looked at the page for today, you're going to miss a lot of information, and, well, you're blowing it, so... We don't want you to do that.
And if you're tuning in for the first time and wonder what you tuned into, you're joining We the People Radio.
Sorry, I thought you did that already.
I did not. With your, I was stalling for time while you showed up.
You are awesome.
I know. Fortunately, I had a story to tell. Anyway, We the People Radio with your host Aaron Ryan, Elizabeth Woodward, and Bob Martin, and we are we're a kind of a nonpartisan but politically incorrect talk show on the air for almost 3 years, and we cover everything under the umbrella of fiscal responsibility, limited government, and adherence to our great Constitution. And on our webpage that Robert Exter does, and he's awesome, quite the artist, by the way, if you go to wethepeopleradio.us and check out the webpage, scroll to the bottom, and his information is on there. So anyway, he's awesome, and he takes care of our webpage on a weekly basis, does a fantastic job. And there is an individual link to every show that we've ever done on the right-hand side. If you scroll down, you'll see archives dating back to our maiden voyage. So
a lot of good topics in there.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
we talked about
everything.
We talked about some political Islam last week,
yeah,
which
we
seemed
did.
To be a really nice lead-in for today's program.
You know, we've got a friend in London who works with the English Defense League. They are sort of an underground organization that are combating radical Islam in Great Britain. As we know, it's gone crazy over there. And then, you know, we've had some wonderful guests on. We've talked about everything. We had a wonderful woman from an Iranian-American citizen who has a lot of expertise in foreign policy. And so, you know, we're no slouches here. Well, Aaron and I are, but our guests are not. So we bring them.
We slouch where you can't.
We bring them to you, and we know little to nothing about these topics when we first start out. And like you, at the end of this 2-hour show, we've learned a lot.
And there you have it.
Okay, and I've blathered on long enough for Aaron to get her computer turned on, and now she's ready to rock and roll.
Couldn't get the page up. I couldn't get the page
going.
You're
ready to rock and roll.
What the heck? Hey, so we have Sam and Kate online, huh?
You bet we're here.
Right on. Oh, whoops.
Oh, hold on.
It's Groundhog Day. We're going to start over again. It's like the really short. Oh.
Yes, yeah,
the groundhog?
We're doing something special today. Bob was in here really early this morning. Our guests are Skyping in, and we're concealing their identity a little bit with some special magical electronics.
Voice yes, software, yes, so that's kind of fun.
So we've gone the extra, well, I shouldn't say that I have, but Bob Martin has gone the extra mile with our guests to conceal their identity because they've got a story that's going to blow your socks off.
Exactly.
So bear with us. If we stumble a little bit because, you know, a couple of weeks ago we had Aaron was out in the field and broadcasting live from a town near us, and so we're doing lots of new stuff.
We're experimenting.
And every time
we like to experiment,
yes,
live, though.
Yeah.
We like to experiment so that you can enjoy the ride with us.
Yes.
Well, we actually have a very good connection here.
Right
as
on.
You alluded to, their voices are changed, disguised, and
like
we
that.
Welcome Sam and Kate Call to the program now.
So I say we should just jump
very
right
cool.
into it.
So our topic is escape from Al Qaeda. We're not going to tell you what country they escaped from, because Sam's got some. He's going to paint us a great picture of this country, and then are you going to have us guess what country it is, Sam? Are we still doing that?
We're going to try.
Right on, because I think it's cool. All right, go for it.
Okay, this is Joanne, this is Kate, and
hi,
I would like to say good morning to Aaron, Elizabeth, and Bob, and thank you for having us on your show, and thanks to your audience for taking the time to listen to our gripping story.
Well, we're thrilled to have you on, thank you.
We've read your gripping story, so if it's half as good being told as it is in print, and for those of you that want to send a copy, it's on the page, so. All right, fire away, you guys, it's all you.
Okay, I'm going to describe a country. You in your audience, I'd like to try to figure out what it is. First of all, it's a predominant Muslim country, but secular. Any religion can be practiced there so long as they operate from a book. So the Quran, the Bible, Torah, those are all okay, but if your religion is not based on a book, then they didn't like you. Second, it's one of the highest literacy countries in the world, with 97% literacy in males and 85% in females. The World Health Organization said that from their records that they have proven 100% infant inoculations and the best prenatal and postnatal care in the world for babies. They have free health care. If you can't get the health care you need in that country, go anywhere in the world. They paid all the costs plus your travel expenses and the travel expenses of a family member or two to travel with you while you're getting your health care. Education is free, and it's limited only by your brain. We knew a young man that was getting his PhD in England. He had a wife and four kids. The government paid all their tuition costs, fees, expenses, plus his monthly stipend was £4,950. That's over $7,000. The first car that you bought as a newly married couple cost you half of the dealer invoice. Gasoline was 44 cents a gallon. The day you got married, the government gifted you $46,000 in cash. Your home, and these were new, between 2,000 and 2,700 square feet, cost you 10% of your salary for 20 years, and the title was given to you at that time. That payment also included electricity, gas, utilities, sewage, etc. The women were emancipated as the first act of the regime that overthrew the old despot king, and they owned their own businesses. They were not required to wear burqas or anything like that. They drove their own cars, went shopping by themselves. They were doctors, lawyers, etc. They did not permit the radical portion of the Quran, which was added by the Ayatollah Khomeini, to be spoken or taught in that country. What country is that?
Go ahead, Elizabeth.
It's Libya.
Libya.
That was Libya prior to February 2011.
No way.
Absolutely. Well, everything you've heard about Libya is not true. And we were there. We saw it. We were business people. We were not political activists or anything. But we had been doing business in Libya for years, and So Libya has been a part of our lives for 6.5 years, and it's a travesty what's happened.
Now, when you describe the Libya before 2011, how is that financially sustained?
Well, Libya has had, of course, huge reserves of oil and gas, and Libya only spent about half of the money they took in from their natural resources. And, you know, Libya had the highest standard of living in Africa, higher than India, higher than China. Average salary was $15,800 a year. If you were a college graduate and you couldn't get a job, they paid you $15,200 a year until you got a job. The people, anytime they needed money, they could go to a bank and get a 500 dinar, which was about $450 gift without any note or anything. If you were hungry, the government had many warehouses of food, and you could go get 50 kilos of flour, 50 kilos of rice, and 20 kilos of cheese, and 20 kilos of powdered milk, and enough money to buy an animal anytime you needed it, no questions asked. During Ramadan, every family member could get a $500 gift. So they were a very wealthy country, and Libya is a large country, the seventh largest footprint in Africa, 17th largest in the world, but only 6.5 million people. And of course, it's Sahara, except for the first few miles on the coast and then in the Green Mountain area. So not a very heavily populated country, plenty of oil and gas income forever.
So that just allows for an outstanding quality of life.
Sure, and they shared the wealth with the people. It was, you know, it was unlike any place we travel all over the world. Our business was in the oil and gas area. We rejuvenate oil wells and cleaned up pipelines and stuff like that. We traveled every place. And really, the wealth in Libya was disseminated down to the people much better than any place else. Saudi Arabia's got a few rich folks and a whole lot of poor folks.
So I'm guessing no liberals lived in Libya. Because, you know, they don't like to use the natural resources.
No, not many.
Libya is, the interesting thing about Libya is that before their revolution, when the Gaddafi revolution, or the bloodless coup, whatever you want to call it, the old king, the old despot king, he was put in place there by the British. He was actually not a king. He was just installed as a puppet government because there was a whole lot of oil and gas in Libya that they wanted to extract. They were getting rid of Italy, who had been occupying Libya forever. The average salary of a Libyan during that time was 60 dinar a year. No Libyans owned any land. The Italians, the British, whoever were there controlling their country, they owned all the land. And the Libyans were just, if you will, the slaves or the workers on the land.
And this was at what period of time?
This was until
40.
Yeah, up until 1968, I think, when the Gaddafi coup took over.
Okay.
Libyans took back their country. First time in their history they owned their own country. And what happened during that time was Gaddafi, it was bloodless. The old king just ran off. He was a despot. He was a pedophile. He was not worth anything. He ran off, and they owned the country then. And so they didn't know how to run a country. They started from scratch. But the first thing he did was give every Libyan that had been working on land, he gave them the land. And that's the first time in the history of Libya the Libyans owned their own land. So that's kind of an amazing fact most people don't know, but in the 8,000-year history of Libya, they've been occupied goes way back to Mesopotamia, and, you know, Rome. Rome has, I think, Leptis Magna is the biggest city Rome ever built, and the ruins are pristine in Libya. They're beautiful.
No kidding.
Yeah, Libya's a real interesting country.
All right, we want to hear more from you about that, because that part of the story is really interesting, since most of us have... I mean, we heard about Libya, I think, when we were in school, but, you know, you said Mesopotamia, and I was back in sixth grade all of a sudden. So we'll continue with Sam and Kate on this fascinating journey, and we'll hear about how Libya changed, and they got to go for the ride. You're listening to We the People Radio here at KCNR, 1460 AM, Community Radio for the North State.
What shall we do about them? But good.
transmission.
Radios appear.
We took you up and we put you in the backseat.
Dominance.
Submission.
Radios appear.
From year to year, we looked up for the venture.
Dominance.
Submission.
Radios appear.
Dominance.
Submission.
Dominance.
Submission.
We're back. Fresh coffee in hand. We're talking to Sam and Kate. They have a little voice modification going on because they've got a pretty frightening story to share. Hey, and we were talking off air, and you know, the connection we have with Sam and Kate is pretty darn good. But, you know, we're hearing some funny things in the lines, and it could just be our technology, our skill level, whatever. But in case it's the NSA or Verizon or AT&T or anyone else, we would like to wish you all a happy Father's Day.
And we're really
glad you're listening in.
We're right there with you.
Yeah, we might as well say hi to all our special friends.
I think we've gotten to a point now where, now that we're over being horrified about what our government's doing to us, now we're just going to make fun of them.
Yeah, because it's the confirmation. It's just confirmation we needed. Actually, I don't think anybody considered it a true news flash.
Well, Sam, and you know, Kate and I were talking about this before we went on the air when we were getting set up, and we're like, well, what kind of a country are we living in that we have to take all of these measures to get a broadcast on the radio?
I know.
We're living in a freak show right now. The inmates are running the asylum.
So, Sam, we were also talking a little bit about there was a little confusion or disbelief over the fact that actually the quality of life for the citizens of Libya was actually really high during the reign of Gaddafi. Is that correct?
Absolutely. We've traveled all over the world, I promise you. And those folks there wanted for nothing. And the thing that was amazing, they had been shut off from any modern technology and all the benefits and everything for 38 years because the Gaddafi regime threw out the oil companies because they would not clean up their mess and they wouldn't give a fair share to Libya, etc. And the other thing was that he was not ever a radical Islamist. In February 2011, the Department of Defense, this is U.S. Department of Defense, said that Gaddafi and his regime were the biggest asset the United States had in fighting terrorism. And 2 weeks later, the then Secretary of State came out and said he was the worst guy that ever drew breath and he'd be killed. So, you know, the things that happen in government, you know, politics are a mystery to most of us lay folks. And unfortunately, you know, we're business people. And we did a huge amount of business in Libya, so we had a vested interest in seeing Libya succeed. But the political side was so nasty that it caused us all kinds of problems. And what Kate's going to do now is she's going to give you the big hook. She's going to tell you the really tragic part of our story. And then we will segue from that back to how we got into Libya and some more details about Libya. But she wants to tell you about the 100 days when we were trapped in Tripoli.
I'm back.
All right, we're ready.
We're ready. We think
okay.
We're ready.
We have so much to say. It's hard to. It's like going through a tunnel. You know, squeezing everything into one little tunnel. But what I would really like to talk about is our escape from Al Qaeda, our capture by Al Qaeda in Tripoli in August of 2011. We were in Tripoli from May 2011 till the end of August, I think the 25th of August 2011. We were there with an NGO fact-finding commission by invitation from this fact-finding commission. The reason they invited these people, we were a member of, this group was from England, Italy, France, there was somebody from Pakistan, we were a multicultural group. We were the only Americans in the group, and we were invited in because the Libyans had asked the UN to come in and do fact-finding on the ground before they took any activity in Libya, whether it be no-fly zone or whatever, because the Libyans were saying that it's not true what they're saying. This is not happening here. The UN turned them down, I think, two or three times, which is against their own charter. So they organized their own non-governmental fact-finding commission. The lady who headed it was from Italy, and we were invited to come in, and we went in the first part of May, and what happened to us there was really pretty astounding, but we got involved with the tribes of Libya because they were having all these meetings in Tripoli to try to develop their own constitution immediately because they were afraid what was going to happen happened. As we were meeting all these people, we had known the prelate of the Catholic Church, Bishop Martinelli, in the past, and he invited us to come over and meet with him. He asked us while we were there if we would please help the Libyans accept a ship of medicine and medical supplies being sent from a member of the Catholic Church in Rome, a patron of the Vatican, if you will.
It was actually organized by the Pope.
Yeah.
He had formed a committee himself, Cardinal Turkson and another Monsignor, and they wanted to provide medicine, medical supplies to Tripoli, not to Benghazi. And the Pope had actually gone to the UN twice and said he would act as the moderator for peace talks in Libya. He went to the UN twice. They never responded to him. Then NATO took over the fight. He approached NATO three times officially, and he would act as the moderator for peace talks. They never responded to him. This is the man that's head of a third of the people of the world. And the UN and NATO would not even respond to his request for peace talks. And he and Cardinal Turkson and one Monsignor was going to be the committee to mediate peace talks. So the Pope instigated a huge gift of medicine, medical supplies to go to Tripoli.
But the Libyans, in their own naive way, said that they didn't want to appear like they needed help. They had a very strange way of looking at the war. We tried to tell them that they needed to do some positive PR, tell the world who they are, what's going on, and they said it's not their way. They said they believe that their God and the truth will pull them through this. And we told them, you don't know the Western media. you need to do something.
They're going to give God a run for his money.
I know, really. So as time went by, we were working on this we were working on this ship, and as each day went by, the war was getting closer and closer to Tripoli. The road that went from Tripoli to Tunisia that you had to take to get out of Libya, because there was no flying going on, was being bombed alternately from day to day, and there would be a day where you might be able to go, and then a day you couldn't go, so we were trapped there. We did not believe that the war was actually going to come in and take over all of Tripoli, because Tripoli was, I would say, 99% behind the current regime.
In fact, in the country of Libya, 90% were in favor of the government they had. There was such a small percentage of these radical Islamists that have been there forever in the northeastern corner of Libya. And those guys, they were bad to begin with. And that's the ones that were supporting the...
That's the ones that NATO joined hands with and had to bring in close to 200,000 mercenaries to take over that country. Mercenaries from all Al-Qaeda, most of them, armed Islamist radicals, if you will. I don't know if we can use the word Al-Qaeda anymore. We were told not to, but to me, they're all the same.
Al-Sharia, Libya Fighting Group.
Yeah.
God knows what. They have a million different names. They change the names of their organizations every day. They change their names every day.
But they're all the same. Radical Islamists.
If NATO had not delivered more sorties into Libya than in all of World War II, then NATO would have never beaten up the Libyans enough to take over that country.
No, they bombed hospitals and schools and roads and water supplies and power plants, and they embargoed Tripoli from food and medicine and fuel and, I mean, things that are completely against international law.
Every illegal act of war was committed by NATO and the UN, and that's all orchestrated from Washington, D.C. Real sad state of affairs. And as I said, we're business people. We saw it with our own eyes. We've always supported our military. We sent air conditioners to Iraq during that time. Home Depot had a deal. We bought the air conditioner. They paid the shipping. We sent hundreds of air conditioners to the troops over there. We sent boots and blankets and stuff because our government wouldn't equip them properly. We've been big supporters of our military. Couldn't believe what was going on there.
Anyway,
that's totally, and see, that's stuff that we
obviously, those of us who didn't work in Libya or have any contact with them, we follow what the, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, all we know is what the media tells us, unless folks like you tell us different.
Which is why we have this show.
Libya's real easy country to do this to.
Oh yeah, because they didn't understand the power of the press.
They're a closed country, you know. They don't
sure.
talk. Their news does not go out beyond themselves. So
sitting ducks.
Hey. Yeah, absolutely. And it's been like that for a lot of years, actually. What happened on about the 21st of August was NATO decided they were tired of fighting, and they just decided to come in and take over Tripoli. About 2 or 3 days of constant bombing and shelling and Apache warship gunships firing. You know, I would say we'd have a half an hour off and then continue on again, hitting the hotel we were in, hitting streets, everywhere. Finally, they started bringing in these brigades of Al-Qaeda little trucks with the anti-aircraft guns on the back of them, big ships coming in from Benghazi, just offloading them in the port. The first night they took over, they killed 1,300 people within 12 hours, just Apache gunships just mowing people down in the streets. I mean, we couldn't believe what we were seeing. Once they got a hold, once Al-Qaeda was in there, these mercenaries were in there, they had checkpoints every 500 feet. They looted every store. They broke into every car. They took over hotels. They took whatever they wanted. It was complete and utter anarchy, or whatever you want to say. So we were stuck. We were in the Carinthia Hotel. We had moved to that hotel from the Radisson because the Radisson didn't have any... the internet was not good there, and it was off most of the time. When this happened, there were a bunch of people that came into the Carinthia. It was only open on part of it because most of the people, all the men left. All the men that worked in the hotel left. The only people running the hotel left were women. They had run off. Even the security guards ran off. So we ran into a young man in the lobby. His name was Anton Hay. He was the FIFA coach from Germany for the country of Libya. He had been stuck there. He approached us, asked us if we were Americans. We said yes. He said, "We plan to get out of here." I said, "The best we can." And so he asked us if he could join us. We said, "Absolutely." We also were joined by the sister of the president of Mauritania. Her name was Fatima Tou. She was part of our group, a Bahraini prince, a man from Texas who was Boy Scout leader. I don't know why he was there, actually.
He was a ne'er-do-well trying to sell guns or influence or whatever. You know.
Boy Scout leader?
Yeah, I don't know what he was. We never did really find out.
You know, if you travel abroad, you'll meet almost anybody.
There you go. I'm telling you.
But we had all those folks climbing on to us because we were known so well,
and actually, a few weeks before that, the Russian ambassador, his name was Maxim Maximov, had called us at the hotel and said, "Could I come meet with you and bring my security guy?" We said, "Sure." And he said, "The reason I'm calling is because Russia is saying, my people or my government saying to me, what we're hearing on the radio and what you're telling us are two different things happening in Libya. We want more information." And he said, "I went to the government here and they said, well, if you want the truth, go talk to these two Americans. They know exactly what's going on." So he came to talk to us.
Now, you have to expand on that. The reason we knew what was going on is because, as we said, we've been in Libya for years. We knew lots of Libyans, and there were a lot of young men that were soldiers that would go out and fight for 3 weeks and then be given a week off. And we knew a lot of these guys, and they were telling us almost daily what was going on in the field and how the rebels, the only way they could advance was if the NATO gunships were blowing up the road in front of them, then they'd advance, and the Libyan military back up, and then it'd sway back the other way. And all the information that the news was putting out was incorrect because, of course, they had an agenda. And so the Russian ambassador came to us for the truth. It was funny that the Libyans wouldn't even talk to their own government, but they talked to us. They didn't trust anybody. Are we getting up on a time break with
you all? We better take a quick break. Otherwise we'll just hear 30 seconds from you at the end and get cut off a lot. All right. You are listening to Sam and Kate tell their story about pre-crazy Libya, and then the one we think that is Libya. You guys are going to love the rest of this.
How little we know, How much to discover?
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.
And we're back. We're talking with Kate and Sam. We won't tell you who they are or where they are. They're telling us a story of a beautiful country in Africa, Libya, and what it used to be before a small, small, radical group of Islamists partnered up with NATO, went in and destroyed that country.
And we helped a whole lot.
Killed.
Unfortunately.
And completely destroyed a beautiful country.
By we, you mean the United States.
Yeah, correcto.
Yeah.
Not you, Elizabeth, and I.
And those people,
clear.
And they never saw it coming because they had a closed country, so they didn't receive news from the outside world. They didn't know what was happening. They were taken by surprise. They had a great life using their natural resources. Every citizen was well taken care of, which is what so many in this country seem to think they want, as long as they can do it by taxing us to death and not actually touching any of our natural resources.
All right.
So anyway.
So back to you, kids.
Off my soapbox.
Okay, what happened when we were trying to get out of there, you know, the city was overrun, and these guys, the armed Al-Qaeda types, were now in the lobby of the hotel, and they were shooting up, and we had to get out of there. And the hotel actually loaned us the van, and there were seven of us in our troop with a driver and a spokesperson from the hotel, and we're going up and down the coast of Libya because Malta had sent in a rescue ship, and we couldn't find it. And we were 42 miles east of Tripoli and back into Tripoli and back and forth. And this is every 100 meters an Al-Qaeda checkpoint where these young guys, drunk on drugs with long beards, shooting their guns in the air. And our drivers were telling them that we were news people. So that was all Akbar. Everybody was happy about that. You know, if they knew who we were, then we wouldn't have had that big greeting. But that's a long story.
Yeah.
It was getting dark. We went back into the port of Tripoli the second time. And then this fool, the monkey with the drum is the guy that always ends up leading everybody. Well, this guy had the only satellite phone. And so the reason we were traversing back and forth for hours and hours and hours in harm's way was because of his intervention and speaking to the Malta premier and everything. And when we got to port the second time, he went up into one of the tugboats and was an hour having Al-Qaeda speak to the rescue ship, which was hiding 3 miles offshore. And finally, I got up and I went over. I got out of the van. I went over there and I said, "What in the world are you doing?" He said, "Oh, everything's fine. We're talking back and forth." And when I was walking back to the van, then 30 vehicles came out of every direction. Half a dozen of these young guys, all of them with AK-47s, pointing their guns at us. One old guy that was the leader, and he said, "Your game is up. We know who you are." And they took us back to their torture center. We were interrogated. They took all our belongings. We could hear them dragging young wounded soldiers upstairs, and they were making god awful sounds. Then they had a British film crew come in there and film each one of us individually. And we were interrogated, we were asked if we were okay, were we treated well, etc. And then after all that, I kept demanding to get our passports back. I said, "We're American citizens. We want our passports back. We want to get the hell out of Dodge." And finally, after the interrogation and everything, then this big, tall, bald-headed, fully bearded, fat so-and-so was an imam. He came in and looked down his nose. They called him Sheikh. He looked down his nose at us. And what he said in Arabic was, "When we went to the rescue ship, we were to be killed, chopped up, burned, and blame our deaths on Gaddafi." I didn't hear that, so I was adamant to get our stuff and go to the rescue ship, which would have been east. And the driver from the van had changed, and the guy who was the IT man from the other hotel was now the driver. And we'd known him, but we never were friendly with him or anything. Turns out he was a rebel. And when we tried to go to the van to go east to the rescue ship, he said, "No, He said, this van is going back to the hotel. It's going west. And I said, no, we're going to get out of this country. He said, no, what you didn't hear the imam say.
He pulled us off to the side.
He took joint, I mean, he took Kate and
Sam
over to the side and said, you know, what you didn't understand the man say was you'd be killed when you go towards the rescue ship. And so he said, we need to go back the other direction. I think I can take back roads and get us back to the other hotel before they know you're gone. I said, okay, great. He said, now then, the only thing you have to do is pay these mercenaries, because they're going to be paid 2,500 dinar each for each one of you that they killed, and another 1,000 dinar to chop you up and burn you. And I had, luckily, $19,800 left, and that was a little more than they were going to be paid to kill us. And so I bought the freedom of the seven of us in that troop. We got back to the hotel. They really let us go because they knew they were going to have another shot at us. We weren't getting out of Libya. We were just getting out of their hands.
How did they get our names?
And the way they got our names, they had a list with our names on it. And there was a guy, an American, an attorney,
who lives in Lebanon.
Bad guy, lives in Lebanon with Hezbollah, named Franklin Lamb. And he had given them our names in the hopes that we'd be killed, because we had discovered he was a double, triple spy, whatever. Sorry piece of human being. And he had given our names to the Al Qaeda group. And that's how they knew who we were. And when they were interrogating us, you know this guy, you've been working with that guy. You know, it was really a real tough time. They still have our names to this day. We're still on their kill list. They threatened us, told us they know where we live, and that one day we'll see him at our door. The first miracle was the driver that got us out of there. The second thing that happened, we got back to the hotel and we knew we were on their list. We knew they were looking for us. And this Fatima II from Mauritania, she knew one of the guys that was running the IOM rescue ship. That's a UN
immigration ship.
And she was able to get us on the ship leaving the next day.
Yeah,
the next day. And he slipped us out of the hotel in one of their vans, got us through all the, there's 20 checkpoints at the port to get us in there, and got us on that ship. That was the second miracle. That ship we were on was the worst 2 days of our lives, I think. It was hot. It was a car carrier converted into a people hauler, and no air conditioning. No shades on any of the windows. It was Mediterranean in late August, hot.
Had about 500 people, yeah. Most of them
Filipinos,
and maybe some from African Sahara, some other areas.
No food. They had moldy bread, hot water, and some out-of-date juice and some sweet things. If you drank the juice, you had to immediately go do the green apple quick step.
It was the slowest ship in the world.
Two bathrooms for the whole ship. And of course, everybody was seasick, and you know, anything you took in, you immediately had to go to the rail or whatever. And finally, 2 days, and we were in Benghazi. Now, we were real trepidatious about going to Benghazi because that was the head of the snake. But what happened is all the bad guys in Benghazi had shifted to Tripoli to kill everybody they could there, and so Benghazi was really fairly open. And the IOM guy had arranged for us, instead of going to one of the refugee camps on the border of Egypt by bus, he arranged for us to be taken into Benghazi, into a hotel, and for us to try to make our way out from there. And we ended up at a nice hotel there. The number three in command in the NTC, which was the rebel government that the U.S. installed the second week or third week in February, nice guy, spoke very good English. He didn't know we were on their kill list, so he showed us great mercy and
very poor communication between Tripoli and Benghazi, thank God.
And he invited us to break fast with him. That was the end of, you know, near the end of Ramadan. And then he arranged for us to be put on an airplane that night going to Tunis. So we actually slipped the noose three times. We had three miracles that got us out of their hands and got us out of Libya. And we've been being debriefed by four different U.S. intelligence agencies in the last few months.
Hey, Sam, before we head into that segment, let's take our last break here at the top of the hour.
Okay.
We're going to be back on this riveting tale. Got Bob running all over the place over there. Are we good? All right. Going to hear back from us here at KCNR 1460 AM. Just a couple of minutes. Hang with us. We've got a few minutes before the top of the hour and the news break, so we're going to jump back to our guests who are somewhere, and we won't tell you where because we don't even know where, telling us a story about how they got into Libya and got back out again. You're back.
Okay, now then, when we arrived in Tunisia, we fully expected our government to finally step forward and help us. Anybody traveling outside the United States and thinks, if anybody has any dimension, believes the U.S. government is going to help anybody, if they really need it, forget it. Because the U.S. government was not giving any help to anybody. We finally got back without any help from them at all. And when I landed at the airport in the United States, I was snagged and interrogated for 3 hours by the FBI.
I wasn't.
Joanne had secreted the stuff in the sister of Mauritania. Her first cousin, Joanna, was a computer expert, and she had produced a external hard drive for us, and she'd given it to Kate to have her secret on her person. So when they formatted our computers and everything, the external hard drive was available to us, and it went through customs and nobody, it wasn't anything to declare, nothing illegal about us having it, but it had over 200 gigabytes of information that nobody wanted us to get out of Libya with. And we found out from one of the intelligence agencies has been interrogating us or debriefing this lady that I was blackballed at that time. And the reason we have been so devastated by financially from our loss of business and everything in Libya and been completely unable to even get an interview for a job because we're on the list. And when we go talk to somebody, of course, they hear it all, and then a friendly phone call is made. Don't talk to these people. Don't hire them or anything. We're well qualified. We're productive people, you know. And that's real devastating. But Libya follows home, and they continue to call us. We were appointed as the official spokespeople of the Libyan tribe because they don't trust any foreigners except us. We were there in their tough times, and we told them we wouldn't do any business there until the blood quit running in the street. And they were impressed with that. But, how did two business people end up in Libya? Because we're not adventurers at all. You know, we're business people. We're very well qualified business people. But we were exclusive marketing agents for some proprietary products that rejuvenated oil wells and cleaned up pipelines and sludge pits and fracking fluid. And we had a huge amount of business we did for years in China, Indonesia, Venezuela, and other countries, but payment was always slow, and we couldn't litigate in China because it was of national security, and so if they didn't pay it, you couldn't do anything about it. We were looking for new markets. Libya had not had any new technology in 38 years, so we thought we would start to explore that possibility. And when the treaty was signed in 2006, We then made a full press to go into Libya to see if we could do business there. Our first trip in there was in January 2007. We actually walked out with a contract to treat 2,700 of their monster wells. That was about $1 billion. That's with a B.
How many, Sam?
$1 billion worth of our product.
2,700 wells.
So, you know, we hit a home run, first shot out of the barrel.
Yeah, and, no kidding.
The Libyans, you know, everybody was happy to see us. We went in there with security front, back, left, and right. Joanna, who we'd been talking with her, she was the cousin of the sister of Mauritania, and she said that we needed to go in there with head garb and stuff prepared for Kate to wear. So, whenever we got there, that was not true. And I called her in Mauritania, and she speaks Spanish, I did too. I said, what about all this head garb? She said, well, you know, it's better to be safe. But no head garbs were required. We didn't need any security. Everybody that saw us on the street greeted us and said, oh, we're so happy to see you. We're glad to see you in our country. Can we help you? Et cetera. So it was a greeting we didn't find as Americans in any other part of the world. That was something that was foreign to us, because we had heard all these nasty things about Libya, and it just didn't happen. And the Libyan ministers talked to us. They asked us to stay over an extra week so they could discuss how the Western world worked. So our
hey guys, we're going to hit our hard news break. That crazy sound is actually Ferris Bueller's day off. You get 5 minutes off now from the retelling of the story. We're coming back with Sam and Kate and more about Libya at the top of the hour. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Another crazy day at We the People Radio. This is Hour 2. You are joining your hosts, Aaron Ryan, Elizabeth Woodward, and Bob Martin. And if you're just tuning in for the first time, we are KCNR 1460 AM. We are Free Fire Media and Community Radio for the North State.
And happy Father's Day to the NSA.
Yes, yes. And Verizon, AT&T, and many others.
Homeland Security, who's moving to town here soon.
Yes, we're really happy that you're listening and tuning in, and we want to say hello to you.
And we don't normally disguise our guests' voices like we're doing today, but we may have to disguise our voices after today.
I was going
to
say, hey, let's everybody jump on.
Yeah, so today we're talking about Libya and... gosh, you know, if you didn't know it, prior to 2011, Libya was a beautiful, prosperous, happy country with citizens well cared for. They had a great quality of life. And then a small minority faction of radical Islamists teamed up with NATO and went in and destroyed that country, killed a lot of people, and... if they haven't already, are in the process of taking that country over. It used to be the place to be. So our guests today are Kate and Sam, and their voices are disguised because they worked in Libya, and during the takeover were caught right in the middle and managed to escape, even though they were temporarily caught by Al-Qaeda. So they're telling their story, and I think they're going to probably touch a little bit on what our government did after their escape. And back to you folks.
Okay, this is Kate. I just wanted to say, I wanted to add something that's real important that most people don't know in this country especially, and are really shocked to understand, is that Gaddafi was not running Libya. In the 2006 treaty that Condoleezza signed with Libya, it was a requirement that he step down. The truth be known, he had turned into more of a spiritual type person. He did more writing, he was more into the philosophy part of his life, I think. We never met the man. But I met him through thousands of Libyans, through their version of him, through their heart, through their eyes, if you will. But what happened while we were there, we couldn't understand. When we were in the fact-finding commission, one of our questions was, what role does Gaddafi play in this government? Is this government? We couldn't understand that. And we were told by a group of university professors that we were taken to interview how the Libyan government worked and how it's a tribal culture. And the tribes all have leaders, and every member in Libya is a member of a tribe. And that culture itself is a shadow government. The government that's actually running Libya is was the People's Congress, and they had a prime minister, and they were elected. If people had problems that they couldn't solve, they have the right to go to their tribes. Their tribal leaders will take it to the heads of the tribes. That's not solved, then it goes to the People's Congress. If that's not solved, then they have they can ask Gaddafi for his opinion. He can choose to come and give his opinion or not give his opinion. It's up to him. And that was the role he played. And these professors said, you know, you have to understand that countries like Libya if you will, Syria, Pakistan, Afghanistan, that are tribal cultures still to this day, are not mature enough for the Western form of democracy that you see in America. That it will not work in this country. We have a very basic form of democracy, if you will. People can speak their mind to their tribal leaders. He said that's what works for us right now. And so we were shocked. You know, I mean, we were trying to figure out, in the world they talk about how Gaddafi's this dictator, how he does this, he wasn't even there, and the U.S. government knew it because they required that in the treaty of 2006. McCain knew it. He was there. In 2009, I think, they went in and signed another treaty. They required the government to get rid of half of their weapons and all their nuclear development in the first treaty, and the second treaty was a requirement to get rid of another half. The only request Libya made in that second treaty was that if they are attacked by any foreign nation, that the United States will come and help them, protect them, fight the invader. They just didn't know the United States was going to be the invader.
Well, people have there was a question in the chat room, why was Gaddafi killed by the people there in the revolution?
No, he was killed by three-letter guys. He wasn't killed by the people.
Three-letter guys.
He was the Al-Qaeda. There were 250,000 mercenaries brought into Libya to fight. Because the Libyan people are really, you know, the only ones who knew how to fight were the soldiers, and they were loyal to the regime. So you had all these mercenaries, these hard guys, that were well-armed, well-trained, well-equipped, well-financed, brought in by NATO. And the only way they could win is if the NATO gunships killed everybody in front of them. The people did not support that. This is an absolute farce. Now, I'm going to tell you the truth about why Libyan Gaddafi had to be blown up. And there's three reasons, and it doesn't have anything to do with oil. Number one, African Bank. Gaddafi, way back there, had started organizing the African Bank, and the purpose was to have a gold-backed currency for the continent of Africa. Because lots of people in the world don't like the fiat currency of the Fed and Euroclear. So all the Arab countries had signed up to be members of the African Bank, and half of the African countries had signed up. Now, can you imagine what a gold-backed currency, international currency, would do to these paper bankers? It would destroy them. So for that reason, he had to go. He had to be killed. Everybody had to wipe that off the face of the earth, because Fed and Euroclear have absolutely no ability to compete with a hardback currency. And we've seen how they've devalued our currency, and everything you buy in the store is costing twice what it was a couple of years ago. So what's our money worth? So that was the first reason. The second reason was AFRICOM. And the United States is bound and determined to have a war with China, and they want to keep China away from the natural resources of Africa. And that's why AFRICOM was formed. That's the military control of Africa. Three countries had refused to sign up. South Africa, Libya, and Mali.
Libya's the strongest country.
And Libya was the strongest country in Africa. They had more money, etc. So since that regime would never sign on, they had to get rid of them for that reason. The third thing was that Gaddafi, as an advisor to all the African countries and Libya, had started a lawsuit in international court for all violations of the treaties from the imperialist countries that had been in Africa forever. This was England, France, Germany, all of them, including the United States. And he included Lockerbie in the mess. And he had brought forward a lawsuit of $7 trillion, and it had legs. It really had a great bunch of legal precedence. So for that reason, they couldn't allow that lawsuit to go forward. So those are the three reasons that Libby had to be blown up. And the fact that Libby had a lot of money, Libby had $241 billion in cash and assets in the Federal Reserve System in the United States, and 150 billion euro, which was more than $200 billion. So here was a country with $450 billion in cash or near cash assets. And the first thing, in the first 10 days of the revolution, of course, the Fed and Euroclear snapped up all that money, and it's all disappeared. Nobody knows what happened to it. Even the Saudis were upset because $65 billion, they know, has gone into hands of radical Islamists that are working outside of their instructions. So, you know, here's a war. They could go kill a bunch of people and take over the country and get paid in the process. In what revolution in the world did the revolutionaries, the first week they're in business, set up a central bank? Never in the history. That happened in Libya. Why did they do it? That was in Benghazi, and that was an instruction of the paper bankers. They wanted to get involved in the banking system first thing. So these are truths you're never going to see, but you can find it. This, you know, just don't take our word for it. Go to Patrick Hasseldine and a lot of other guys that have been open reporting about it. Even Dennis Kucinich talks about the takeover of Libya having been planned years in advance. And their war games actually performed in late 2010, France, England, the United States, for the possible takeover of a North African dictatorship, oil rich. They defined how many ships were going to be put in the Mediterranean. They were going to have a no-fly zone first, and then ground troops if necessary. And those war games were the plan to take over Libya. That predates the Arab Spring and all that. The Arab Spring was all phony. And the prize was to take over Libya, which in turn would allow the entire continent of Africa to be put in the hands of the NATO group. And, you know, the another thing I'm going to throw in just because I can, you know, this mess in Syria, when you see Muslim Brotherhood supporting the rebels in Syria, you know something's got to be wrong with it. And there's a pipeline, a huge gas pipeline that is being constructed now through Syria, that belongs to Russia, and it will give Russia 60% control of all the natural gas going into Europe.
Oh.
And they cannot allow that to happen. So Syria is being blown up to keep Russia away from that huge amount of natural gas. So, you know, the political mess in this world is unbelievable. I have steam that comes out of my ears all the time.
We had the opportunity to meet with quite a few ambassadors while we were in Tripoli. And one of them was the South African ambassador, Dangor. Real interesting man. He's a plenipotentiary for South Africa. And we were talking about these rebel forces that were all over the place and why the Africa itself was very fond of Gaddafi. All the countries were, because he did so many first world activities. He gave money, donated money and help and agricultural help and all kinds of things for Africa. He continually was aiding countries in Africa. And we said, why would South Africa ever back these rebels, this NATO mess here? And he said, I have to tell you something. He said, the then Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, showed up in his country and told them if they didn't back the NATO war in Libya, that they might find some rebels in their backyard.
Oh, great.
He said she did that all over Africa. So he said, what, does she have a closet full of rebels that follow her around?
Bingo.
So, jeez. You know, that's a real disheartening thing when you start understanding that there is an agenda, and the 500,000 dead Libyans were just collateral damage, acceptable.
Especially when we were all watching this and thinking that Gaddafi was a crazy guy with a towel on his head.
Yeah,
we need to get
Gaddafi,
back to...
You know, There was no shooting that ever happened.
No kidding.
They talked about firing. He flew his planes against the protesters. That never happened, and the Russians have verified that. They have satellites, and they watch every plane that takes off. And they said a couple weeks after the claim was made that he'd flown against protesters, there were no planes in the air that fired on any protesters.
The ambassador said that they've been monitoring it forever, and he said that never one time did the Libyan military ever attack their civilians, never put a helicopter, never fired a rocket, nothing against the people.
Huh.
So, you know, what you hear on the news is not necessarily the truth. But, you know, I want you all, I'm going to give you a couple of websites that I want your folks to look at. The first one is Libyan War, the Truth, Part 2. And there's another one, Libyan War, the Truth. Those, if you'll put that in your Google search engine, those will come up as the first two hits. Libyan War, the Truth, Part 2. And it has an embedded video. And Tate made those. And that shows a bunch of photos, our photos, of Libya before the war and during the war. The second one, Libyan War, Part 1, the video has disappeared off it. But those were put on site in March of 2011. And here, this is 2.5 years later, they're still number one on the Google search engine. And that'll give the folks some pictures of Libya before and after. And then the second site I want you all to go to is AITNV.com. And that'll give a little history on our company and our technology. And anybody would like to help support us, of course, there's an opportunity to do that there. As we said, what's happened to us, we went from being on top of the world to being absolutely underneath the world. And we've had every kind of duress placed on us. We didn't know why. You know, all we were trying to do was help get rid of Al-Qaeda and the fundamentalist Muslims that were a real threat to us here. And, you know, that's all we've ever tried to do. And we saw good Libyan people that we knew and those we didn't know getting blown up and their houses destroyed and hospitals and clinics and everything destroyed by our government and other governments.
Under the guise of protecting the innocent.
All nefarious purposes.
Of course.
That's disheartening to us.
On that note, we need to take a quick break. And frankly, it's disheartening to all of us. It seems like lately, all we do is get things confirmed that we deep down kind of already knew was happening.
And hoped wasn't.
Yeah, you kind of hope they're not. But we're going to be right back with Sam and Kate. We're going to hear more about Libya. And nice, Bob. Got a nice little song for us. You're listening to We the People Radio here on KCNR 1460 AM, community radio for the North State.
Let me say, let the war in the cold, let me reach, let me beach, the shores of Tripoli.
And we're back. Hey, for everyone that's listening or you know, even those that don't and think that this type of stuff just doesn't matter.
If they're not listening, then how would they?
If they really think this doesn't matter, it's so easy to say that what's happening in Libya has nothing to do with us and will never impact us. Well, I want to read you just a quick one short paragraph from The Independent, which is a news publication out of the United Kingdom. And honestly, the United Kingdom is better about telling the truth about America than the American media is. And you can actually find a lot of these links to outside news sources by going to the Drudge Report. But I'm going to read you very quickly why this matters. Washington's decision to arm Syria's Sunni Muslim rebels has plunged America into the great Sunni-Shia conflict of the Islamic Middle East, entering a struggle that now dwarfs the Arab revolutions, which overthrew dictatorships across the region. For the first time, all of America's friends, and friends is, quote, has air quotes around it, in the region are Sunni Muslims, and all of its enemies are Shiites. Breaking all President Barack Obama's rules of disengagement, the U.S. is now fully engaged on the side of armed groups, which include the most extreme Sunni Islamic movements in the Middle East.
Hmm.
Thought I'd share that.
Lovely. And Homeland Security is setting up an office in Reading. Yeah. All right, back to Sam and Kate. On that happy note.
Happy Father's Day and Merry Christmas.
Yeah, yeah. Usually we goof around a lot. Today is a lot less goofing because it just, yeah, you suck the goofing right out of us, I guess.
Yeah. Vortex. Okay, go for it. You're back.
Okay. This is Kate. I wanted to say, I wanted to give a little bit of the history since we got home, because there's a whole lot of things. This story continues today. Libya literally followed us home. The Libyan tribal leaders, there's over 2 million Libyans in exile now. The 3 million that are left inside Libya live in complete anarchy, it's akin to the Old West, where you have the gangs that could go and take somebody's home if they wanted, or kill somebody if they wanted, or take their wife and rape them if they wanted. Nobody was there to stop them. That's what's happening in Libya now. There's no security of any kind. And the main groups that are there are the Al-Qaeda groups, the Ansar al-Sharias, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Groups, the Belhajis, who were in Guantanamo. Now that we put in Libya, NATO put him in Libya. He's one of the leaders of the army there now. So they contacted us and asked us if we would help them continue to put the truth out about Libya, because they would like to have a force, like a good force, if you will. They think the Americans might step up and help them get rid of Al-Qaeda in their country so they can go home. And so we said, well, we'll do what we can. And we actually found Dr. Jerome Corsi. He's with WorldNet Daily. You see, he's written about maybe 6 or 7 articles about Libya recently in the last few months. All the information came from us and our people for those articles. The Libyan tribal leaders put together a document and passed it through us to the U.S. government, to anybody we could get to pay any attention to us. And they put out their hand and they said, we as Muslims, peaceful Muslims, will help you go and rid the world, if you will, of these armed Islamists. First, we will start with our country. And then after that, we will join with the tribes of Saudi Arabia, tribes of Kuwait, tribes of Egypt, tribes, all the tribes know each other, worldwide Arab tribes. And we will help you through intelligence, through whatever you need, to rid the world of these armed Islamists. We have the ability to do it. We've had no response from anybody. Nobody's interested in that, I guess.
And, you know, everybody knows that if infidels, if Christians and Jews fight fundamentalist Muslims, then the Muslims are going to have to side with the fundamentalists. The only way that's ever going to be cleaned out is if they clean it out from inside. And here, the Libyan tribes offered to do that. They said, if you'll just quit killing us, if you'll quit attacking us,
and quit supporting the bad guys,
then we will clean them out of our country, and then after that, go country by country and help you clean them out worldwide. And that has been completely ignored, rejected, no response to it at all.
From that point forward, they started giving us information also as to the movements of these people in these countries, other information, intelligence information, and we have had 4 different intelligence agencies in our home, still continuing today.
We provide them with information. Kate talks with the tribal leaders almost daily, and we knew about, not specifically Benghazi, but we knew that on 9/11, the U.S. Property, embassies and stuff, all over that part of the world are going to be attacked. In Egypt and in Libya and Yemen and all over. And we try to tell everybody here, and I'm talking about Democrats, Republicans, everybody. Nobody would listen to us. Kate's dialing finger is 1 digit shorter than it used to be from calling D.C. so many times and nobody talking to her.
She'd
get through the gatekeeper, get to the guy that was in military intelligence, and okay, we'll set up a direct link with those Libyan tribal leaders. Nothing. And when the ambassador was killed in Benghazi, within hours, they called us and they said, these guys, these assassins are hiding in this hospital, in this location, because they were expecting the Marines to be there any minute. And of course, Kate calls everybody she can think of. Nobody wants to talk to her. And a couple hours later, they call and they said, now these sorry guys have shaved their beards and mustaches, cut their hair, and they've got on Western suits. And they're in three black vehicles, one SUV, one BMW, and one Audi. They're driving to Egypt. For sure, your drones can catch them on that. It's a long stretch of highway. They're going to be 6 or 8 hours at 100 miles an hour on that road, you know. And, of course, nobody here to heed any of those warnings. And that kind of intel has been coming. On the 27th, go ahead and tell that story, 27th of April.
Yeah, on the 27th of April, we were told about a ship carrying weapons of mass destruction disguised as a fishing vessel in the Mediterranean north of eastern Libya. It was going to land in Libya. It was sent by the head of Al-Qaeda, Al-Zawahiri, from Turkey. And it was going to land in Libya, be offloaded to the head of the Muslim Brotherhood there, and taken across Egypt into Gaza to be used against Israel.
They have an underground delivery from Egypt into the Gaza. So it would be on land through Libya, on land through Egypt, and underground
now,
to Gaza.
I understand this had nothing to do with Libya. It had to do with weapons going to attack another country.
And they're going to kill Jews. So here's Muslims, good Muslims, going out to help Jews. Have you ever seen that before, heard of it?
Yeah, that seems backwards from what we hear.
Yeah, well, that's because the truth is never there, you know. But Kate was trying to get anybody to do something on that. Go ahead.
One of the people we were speaking to in the intelligence area said, nobody will do anything about this, but I do have a contact that I'm going to just pass this to over in Israel. And so he did, and they don't tell us anything. It's all very hush-hush, but we did get confirmation back. He said, I think that something good happened, and then our Libyans called us and said, their guys inside said, you know what, the ship is missing. So they got the ship.
The Al-Qaeda in Libya were all nervous, jumping around. They couldn't communicate with it by satellite phone or anything anymore. And so they sent out some small ships out in the Mediterranean. They couldn't find it. So for sure,
the ship is missing.
The ship is missing. They got it.
You know, how many tens of thousands of lives were saved because of the selfless acts of the Libyans, you know? But here on this side, as we've said many times, we've been debriefed, continue to be debriefed, and these guys, good guys, really, they come in here and they say, you know, the sad thing is all we can do is take this information and pass it upstream. And it goes to the very top, and nothing happens at that. It's all blocked. So all it is intelligence. And we've asked them to provide some kind of assistance to the Libyans, because can you imagine 2 million people in exile? They can't go back to their country because they'll be killed. How much do you think it costs for 2 million people to live outside of their country for that many, for 2 years or more? The Libyan tribal leaders are working as manservants, and their wives are cleaning houses and short order cooks and stuff just to make enough money to get by. And, you know, the sad fact is that the intelligence community here, all of them that have been here, have said they have no intelligence in Libya. And one of the top guys, one of them we like real well, he sits in here and he says, he shakes his head, he said, you know, you all are blessed, because he said, you're the only people I've ever heard of that ever got out of the hands of Al-Qaeda alive. And then the other thing he says that's real telling is he says, you know, the amazing thing is that here's two people sitting in this particular area, and they can contact anybody in Libya, any part of Libya, and get current, pertinent information about the movements of these bad guys. He said that's impossible for anybody to set up that kind of organization. And that's because our unintelligence organizations here have never tried to understand the tribal culture. We go in and try to change everybody's culture, and you can't do it. And they've learned that. We've learned it in Afghanistan and in Yemen, all these other places, that you have to win the hearts of those folks first. You can't just go try to change their minds tomorrow. I don't care how much money you put on, you know. And so the fact that we're misguided or we're wrong-footed in our foreign relations is evident, because look at all the failures. And then here's two folks, two business folks. All we're trying to do is
get our life back,
rid the world of these bad guys, and we're being destroyed because of it.
The other thing that's real important is that if people say this doesn't affect the United States, let me tell you how it does.
Hang on one second, Kate. We've got to take a quick break, or we'll have Maul at the end. We're going to be right back with Sam and Kate with no further falderall from us. Hit it, Bob. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM.
By the way, we alluded to Free Fire Radio there. I just wanted to get a quick shameless plug in here. You, Aaron, and you, Elizabeth, are going to be guest hosting for Carl and Linda on Free Fire Radio tomorrow morning here on KCNR.
We will be here bright and early.
Between 7 and 9 a.m.
And
for those of you who think climate change is ridiculous, make sure and tune in Tuesday morning to the studio here, because there are four climate change scientists that will be on the radio Tuesday morning, and they don't want to hear from any climate change deniers.
Yeah, so if you're a climate change denier, please call Tuesday morning. Please do.
And the phone number is 530-605-4567. Put it in your speed dial. Call often.
Yeah. Yeah.
Climate change wars on KCNR coming soon.
And especially if you're from the Tea Party.
Exactly.
Because they do not like the Tea Party.
No, because this area is under Tea Party control.
So they want you to call. call. All right.
You should never tell us what you don't want. That's just such a blow it.
And haven't you figured it out by now? We're going to blast it all over the place.
Exactly.
And we love, love, love to make fun of you.
Because we have good intel. And we have even better intel since we met Sam and Kate. Now we have worldwide domination. But, you know, we promise to only use our powers for good. So we've got one more commercial break. But other than that, it's you guys from now till the top of the hour. And before we go, before we run out of time, which always happens, we wanted to know if you guys wanted to come back and talk to us, because we haven't even begun to shred Mr. McCain.
Yeah, because, you know, there was
any of that.
I think that Mr. McCain has been a huge disappointment for a lot of people.
But you guys know exactly how disappointing, and I thought folks should know.
Yeah, we want the skinny on all of that.
What do you think about that?
He's the Manchurian candidate.
Yeah. So
no, we got a lot of dirt on him.
Oh, good!
I knew you did. So,
we had two Manchurian candidates running in 2008. Is that what you're saying?
We had a Manchurian team running. God. So whatever we don't do, we don't have to have the pressure. So whatever we don't get to today, would it be cool with you guys to do this next week?
Sure, absolutely.
Great.
I'm gonna give you one pearl about Tuesday.
Fire on.
Oh yeah, please.
Every day, there are at least 100 volcanoes active in the world. And any large volcano puts out more garbage into the air in one explosion than man can do in 1,000 years. So how in the hell some pea brain thinks that man is so big that we're going to
out-control
God and Mother Nature? To hell with it.
Okay, so make sure you write down the phone number of 530-605-4567.
Write down the pearl of wisdom and call in and repeat it over and over.
Because I'm already getting emails back from people. Thanks, Aaron. We'll be calling in to chat. Let the games begin. Okay, I'm sorry. Back to Libya.
Oh, man, this is going to be so much fun.
This is Kate again. Yeah. I was going to tell you how this mess in Libya is affecting us here in the United States. The people who have taken over Libya and been put in charge, first of all, we put a puppet guy in there who was outside of Libya for 40 years. He was a thief. He stole $80 million when he was an ambassador to India for Libya. Defected with his $80 million, came here and started an anti-Gaddafi campaign so he could keep his money. Worked for the three-letter guys, and they put him back in Tripoli. And he quit about 2 weeks ago, ran off to Switzerland with a couple billion dollars. That was our billion. Yeah, that was our puppet guy. The other guys that are underneath him, the Bel Hajjis and the Sufian Gamo, who was Bin Laden's driver, and Al-Libi's brother. Al-Libi is dead now. He was killed in Afghanistan. He was the deputy for Bin Laden. His brother was put in charge of passports and borders, southern borders in Libya. Since about a year ago, they've been bringing in Pakistanis and Afghanis and anybody who is a radical Al-Qaeda person and giving them a new Libyan passport. New Libyan passport. And they will be, and they're funded with up to $4 to $5 million being sent to the United States, where they get a
permanent green card or multiple entry visa, no question asked. This has actually been going on since October of 2011. Several hundred a month. And they get a new Libyan passport, a different name.
Oh, that's awesome.
As long as their English is real good, they come into the United States, well-funded, $4 to $5 million, and permanent green cards and multiple entry visas. And we know this from two different sources. One of our good friends in Libya, he's a kind of a mental midget. But
he's a real nice guy. He's just easily swayed.
He came from a real good family and became a rebel because he was worth a lot of money to begin with, but they promised him more money than the Saudis. And he told us back in October of 2011 that, there were big opportunities for the Libyan rebels coming in the United States and that they were all being funded. They were setting up businesses and everything. And I said, his name is Hakeem, incidentally. And I said, how is that happening? He said, well, you know, they get $4 to $5 million and, they get set up here and they're able to open businesses and they're expanding. And I said, why aren't you doing that? And he said, well, my English isn't good enough. So we've told this information to the intelligence guys that have been here. And I said, the part that scares me to death, and I'm fearless, is that here are hundreds a month of these really bad guys coming in here with Libyan passports, different names that our people only know here, lots of money, and it's a terrible threat to this country. And they said, well, what do you expect us to do about it? And I said, if it was me, I would look at every Libyan that came in this country since October 2011 and look in their bank account. If they got $4 to $5 million, start waterboarding them to find out who they're working for.
Go see them.
They said, we can't do that. And I said, why not? This is a present danger. This is a threat. Well, you know, there's only 75 card-carrying Al-Qaeda in the whole world. And I said, you mean that's all the budget the CIA's got for Al-Qaeda? And none of them like to hear that, of course. But, you know, it's real simple for any logical thinking person to be able to connect the dots. But, you know, when the administration or whoever doesn't want those dots connected, then we see these things happen.
What they've done is they're saying if we say the word Al-Qaeda in the information we give them, it will be discredited. The reason being that there are very few Al-Qaeda worldwide. They have to be called Islamic terrorists. They have to be called extremists. I said, so it's a semantic game. Everybody in the United States puts an umbrella, at least I do. We know what Al-Qaeda is. They're armed Islamic extremists. And they have a jihad going on or whatever it is. Well, according to the people that are debriefing us, no, that's not correct. We can't use that word. So, you know,
we gave them the location of the two biggest Al-Qaeda or whoever training camps in the world in Libya, where they're bringing in these mercenaries from all over the world. Gave them latitude and longitude, these two locations. And one location is reported to have 80 tanks and over 1,000 pieces of light artillery and medium-sized artillery and all this stuff. They came back to us a few days later and said, well, you know, we've looked at it and we can't find 80 tanks. I said, for God's sakes, you think they're in a line out there with red targets on all of them? I said, they're hidden. You know, you've been fighting these guys in Afghanistan forever. And they said, well, you know, that information discredits what you said.
He said, that wasn't exactly, you didn't say it that way. I said, well, then hire us and train us and tell us how to say it. Because, you know, we're not trained intelligence people.
It sounds like our intelligence people aren't trained intelligence people either.
This is a problem. This is a big problem.
Yeah. But, what a sad deal.
What's happening in Libya right now, though, is really sad. In Benghazi in the last week, there have been almost 100 young men under the age of 20 just slaughtered in the streets by the Ansar al-Sharia groups, which is Sufyan bin Gamal's group, Wassam bin Hamid. Wassam bin Hamid is the guy who helped orchestrate the attack on Chris Stevens and is holding his passport, his wallet, his personal effects, his private documents. And they started a militia. There's the militias, they're called militias, but they're gangs. Full of these radical Islamists. They call themselves the Shield, just because they have to have a name. These Shield people, they have checkpoints every couple blocks, everywhere. And at a checkpoint, you may have to stop your car. They may take all your money. They may take your car. They may take your wife. They may take your kids. They may take you. They may torture you. You don't know. There's no security there. So there has been the eastern tribes have been protesting this mess in Libya. They want it changed. So these young people took to the streets, and they killed over 100 of them just with snipers and with, what were those weapons they were using?
Man pads. And,
No.
14 millimeter cannons and 40.
I have videos of it. You know, where is the UN? The Libyans asked, where is the UN and NATO now?
Also Qatar military. Regular military is in there.
Qatar is a big supporter of the terrorists there.
In and amongst in all Libya. These guys. And everything that funnels to Libya comes through Qatar. So weapons that we saw with U.S. markings, U.S. crates, everything, went to Qatar first and then was delivered to Libya. We saw rockets that had been blown up, U.S. Markings on them. All these things, you know, it's illegal for any weapons made in the United States to be used for any kind of war. Well, I guess that doesn't count. Biggest military base in the world is in Qatar, and that's the U.S. military base. You know, another thing you've got to look at is the number one friend of the current president of the United States is the leader of Turkey. And that guy believes he's going to be the Khalifa when the caliphate is fully set in place. And the first phone call this man made when he was elected president the first time was to that man in Turkey.
And for those of us that are dummies about the Middle East, the caliphate is what?
That's the Islamic takeover of the world.
Okay.
Or at least the Khalifa will be the head of that. And, you know, the another pearl is NATO moved its entire military operations center to Turkey. NATO's North Atlantic Treaty Organization.
I don't know where
Turkey touches the Atlantic, but I must have flunked all my geography classes.
So for those of us that are weak on geography, the rest of it's getting muddied. I guess maybe it's good to just learn with you right now. Hey, got to take one more quick break. Bob's giving me the high sign here. We're going to be back with Sam and Kate. And for those of you that tuned in late, I am super sorry. But you can hear this program again in just a little while at wethepeopleradio.us. And we'll be back with you here at KCNR for the last half of the hour.
You were young and
1460 AM.
Was an open book. You used to say, live and let live. But if this ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give it a cry, say, live and let die.
Okay, we're back. We've got 5 minutes before we end our show today. And I want to throw it back to Sam and Kate real quick and let you guys wrap up the way you want and give us a little clue as to what we're going to talk about next week.
We're going to talk about 20,000 ground-to-air rockets that the U.S. delivered to the rebels through Qatar that now they're trying to get back. And that was one of the reasons Chris Stevens was killed. He was the gun runner originally, and he was trying to get him back through the assistance of Turkey. We want to talk about the Turkish mafia's involvement in Libya. That's where the real corruption in the government happened. We've got about 15 locations in Libya that are absolutely picturesque, like no place in the world, a bunch of ruins that are better than anything Rome or Greece or anybody's got. We want to talk about women's rights. Women had more rights in Libya prior to February 2011 than anywhere in the world. We want to discuss more.
In the United States.
Yeah, we want to discuss some more about the popes being shunned by all the government, about the world organizations. And I also would like to make an appeal. You know, we're very talented folks. We work 20 hours a day getting this information, trying to get it dispersed out, and we are being blocked at every possible avenue. They've come into our home. We've got 200 gigabytes of information they've been trying to get from us, and one group came in here under false pretenses, got a bunch of information, and then threatened us. They told us we need to forget about Libya. We need to start our lives over forgetting about Libya if we were ever going to have a life. And they've proven that they can hurt us because we are absolutely as near destitute as you can imagine. We can't get a job, and we're talented people. We exploited totally in Libya. In those 4 years we were doing business here, I sold $5 billion worth of our products and actually sold a contract, signed a contract with one of the Social Security investment funds to build a new plant there. We had shipped in raw materials, feedstock, and everything. All that was lost and stolen. And, of course, we have no recovery. And if there are any folks out there that need some good, talented people, we want to go to work. We'd like to ask anybody that would like to help us. We're raffling off a car. I know this is you know, we're groveling, but, you know, we really need help.
That's okay. We're good with
and,
that.
There's a real neat, very rare 1935 supercharged straight-eight four-man's Duesenberg at Graham that we're raffling and $10 a ticket or a dozen of them for $100. We would like everybody to try to help support us because we continue to do this, and since we can't get a job doing anything because we're blocked.
The intelligence agencies won't hire us. We told them, you know, they want us to work 24 hours a day. I said, well, can you just at least pay our overhead? I don't think we can do that, but please print out these 1,000 pages, and I'll get back to you tomorrow with more questions.
That's awesome.
I'm serious.
We've got a lot of words left. And the website for the auction or for the car raffle is aitnb.com. And we'd encourage all y'all to go there. Have a big heart to help us. And, you know, we continue to fight the good fight. You know, they have tried. They can't beat us up. Al-Qaeda couldn't get us and kill us and chop us up. And we pray that y'all can help us so this administration here won't do it to us.
Yeah, because we want to, you know, like all of us, we just hide right out in the open. You know, if there are enough of us who step up,
right.
They can't get us all. So
right.
we're proud to stand up with you guys. I know you've been thrown under the bus by the best of them. I don't know if you'd care to share the list next week, but one of them that I know was Glenn Beck.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people are like, oh, why don't they tell their story to Glenn Beck? Well, we'll just trash that pipe dream there.
What did Beck's people tell you when you came to them with this stuff?
They came to us and said they wanted to do at least a one-hour documentary, maybe 2 hours. And they were so excited about it, they moved up their date to come here. They were going to bring their camera crews and everything.
This is the blaze.
Yeah, and when they got here, all they really wanted was our information. And then one of the people they brought in with them was a three-letter person. And that's the group that threatened us.
We needed to forget they were even in our house. But they took our information.
Yeah.
And I told her, if they're not going to do the documentary, I want my information back and I want a letter stating you will not use it. Fine, that will be done. No, nothing's been done. And they don't talk to us.
Huh. What a reputable group. That's fantastic.
So, oh, listen, call us and threaten us, you know. This is, you need to forget it. If you want to ever have a life, don't ever talk about Libya again.
We love hanging out with people like you. You guys are rock stars.
Well, say, not really.
Yeah, no, you're rock stars. Just say thank you. Say thank you.
Thank you so much.
There you go. Right on. Okay, we're going to talk to Sam and Kate next week. We're going to get hammered by a news break here. We got to thank those guys. We're going to have a brand new webpage up for you for next week, and we're going to talk about all the rest of this good stuff. Thanks, Sam and Kate.
Thank you. Have a great week.
Happy Father's Day.
Exactly. Happy Father's Day. Good job, everybody. Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Elizabeth. Good night, John Boy. Good night, Mary Ellen.
See you next week, folks.
All right. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Aaron. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Lots of thanks.
Thank you, America.